What the hell is going on right now? And why is it happening like this? At Wired, we're obsessed with getting to the bottom of those questions, and maybe you are too. I'm Katie Drummond, the Global Editorial Director of Wired, and I'm hosting our new podcast series, The Big Interview. Each week, I'll sit down with some of the most interesting, provocative, and influential people who are shaping our right now. Listen to The Big Interview right now in the same place you find Wired's Uncanny Valley podcast.
Jamaicans take stock of the damage after being hit by one of the most powerful Atlantic storms on record.
We don't really know how badly impacted we have been.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the view from the ground in Jamaica. And in Gaza, the ceasefire falters, but has it been broken?
We're now in this new normal where both sides can still claim that they're holding to the ceasefire, but they're going to have these tit-for-tat attacks back and forth.
Plus, a trip back in time to 1920s New York and a neighborhood known as Little Syria. Also, why sea creatures freak people out.
Just consider the squid.
Look at all the arms, for crying out loud. Like, what chance could you possibly have in an arm wrestling match?
All that and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We begin today in the Caribbean, where Hurricane Melissa's path of destruction barrels toward the Bahamas, having hit Haiti and Cuba today, after first making landfall in Jamaica yesterday afternoon. Melissa is the most powerful storm ever to hit Jamaica.
This morning, I left my house. I went down the road to see what was going on, and I saw residents also doing the same, and they're just clearing debris and checking on their neighbors.
That's journalist Victoria Samuels describing the scene today in Kingston. Samuels says about 70% of the island is still without power.
We're resilient people, but the recovery is going to take time and we're going to need help.
For the latest from the ground, we turned to the director of the Meteorological Service of Jamaica, Evan Thompson. He personally weathered the storm in Kingston, but he says the areas outside the capital were really decimated.
I heard just a moment ago from one person who spoke about his family that is in the southern part of Trelawney, which is one of our northwestern parishes, the parish in which the system, the Hurricane Melissa, actually made its exit off the island. And in that parish over inland areas, I understand that all the houses have lost roofs, that number of buildings have been flattened and trees, of course, as the system moved across that area and really caused quite a bit of destruction there. I've also heard about Montego Bay, also in the northwest, having experienced significant damage with some of the infrastructure there as well. St. Elizabeth, which is in the southwest, has also been impacted severely by the system from what I've understood. I've not seen too many of the photos yet, but I understand that it has also been extremely devastating in that part of the country, in the southwest. So it seems that the western side of the island will show a completely different picture from what I'm seeing here in the east.
Yeah, and probably that picture will become clear in the coming days. Now, the southwestern area of Jamaica that you mentioned, tourists may know it for Treasure Beach and Frenchman's Bay, other attractions.
That's right.
It's also known as Jamaica's breadbasket.
Yes.
What does that mean for the people of Jamaica, given the devastation of the southwest?
It's likely to really be an inconvenience, and that's a mild way of putting it to most of us, because that's not the only place that we have our agriculture really lively, but that is the largest area that we expect most of our food to come from. St. Elizabeth, many of the cash crops are grown there, and so we depend on that. Those persons who work in the markets are also depending on that for their livelihoods. And those persons who grow the crops, of course, it will be a tremendous loss to them, but the general population will start to see prices skyrocket because, of course, with the demand that will be there for the few produce that will be available, I'm sure we'll be seeing some skyrocketing of those prices, as well as an insufficiency of supply. So there's going to be that shortage. We'll definitely have to adjust to how we eat for the next maybe a few months.
Right. As you said, Evan, we're still waiting for a fuller picture of the destruction across the island. Where do things stand, though, with recovery efforts so far? Any word on whether missing people are being found?
I know there are some persons who are searching for their loved ones. just not being able to make contact because there has been some disruption in the telecommunications as well. So some lines are not really getting through. People are not reaching their relatives by telephone. And so that is increasing the anxiety over some areas. So not too much there. But I know that the National Emergency Operations Center has indicated that there is an all clear because that's the signal, of course, for all of the agency heads to do assessments and to see what is really happening on the ground. People can move around very freely and get that kind of information. So I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more as the day progresses.
I wonder how you assess the preparedness by most of the island's population and what the government was able to assist with in advance of the storm.
I think that a lot was done in terms of trying to ensure that people get the information. And the slow movement of Hurricane Melissa over the waters to the southeast of us before actually starting its approach, I think that gave us sufficient time. It bought us sufficient time to be able to do a lot of the work that we needed to do, get the supplies in, do the kind of preparations that would have been necessary. So I think that we really got that opportunity. The only issue is that most persons kind of expected it to move over more the central part of the island. And so those in the northwest in particular, like St. James and where Montego Bay is located, and Trelawney, where the exit of the system actually took place, those areas probably thought they would have escaped more and might not have made sufficient preparation for this event. They thought it would have actually moved over the central part of the island and they would have really been outside of the scope of this kind of devastation. So that might be what we find out as we do our assessments today, that the preparations in that end of the island were not brought to the expected level to get them through it. And, you know, we don't have the experience of a Category 5 hurricane moving across the island. It has never happened. So it's not something that we would have experienced before and known really how to prepare, you know. So we're likely to see quite a bit of devastation with persons not being fully prepared for this system.
I mean, the last time you and I spoke, Evan, was last year, and Hurricane Beryl had just hit Jamaica. Mm-hmm. How has the country recovered from that storm?
There has been recovery. In some areas, there may still be some way that they needed to go. But I know for sure that some of the recovery was a lot slower than we would have hoped. Electricity supply took a little bit of time to get back on target. A number of things took a while to really start getting back to normal. But I think we have, for the most part, recovered. We've started to see all the food stuff coming back to our markets. And so things were looking a lot better. I think there was, and the kind of weather patterns that we've experienced since the beginning of this year really accommodated agriculture quite a bit. We didn't have any severe drought situations. Mm. So the crops were able to survive. So we were really getting back into a kind of groove, a momentum going forward. And then this, you know, so it's really a big setback. But I think we had come to a point where we were really getting back to the normal situation, and then things are now in a reverse, you know, situation.
So at ground level, Evan, what is needed right now in Jamaica?
Well, all that we will have to assess today. I did some assessment in my area, in my organization, the buildings that we have responsibility for, and things are looking pretty good in the east. But again, it's really not good in the west. And so I'm sure, although the government has put a lot of things in place to ensure that we are able to deal with our situation afterwards, should we be impacted, I'm sure that there is still going to be the need for external assistance coming into Jamaica. What exactly we'll need that assistance for is still not very clear because the assessment has just begun. We don't really know how badly impacted we have been, but we do know that there has been a significant setback to the country, and we're going to need all the help we can get to get right back on track.
That was Evan Thompson of the Meteorological Service of Jamaica speaking with us from Kingston.
Israel carried out attacks in Gaza last night, killing at least 100 people, including children. It happened after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered immediate and powerful strikes, in spite of a ceasefire that went into effect earlier this month. Netanyahu places the blame on Hamas for breaking that ceasefire. He says the group delayed handing over remains of Israeli hostages and killed Israeli soldiers. Hamas denies those claims. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Screams filled the air in Gaza once again last night. This man is standing at the doors of an ambulance, which is carrying the bodies of his loved ones into a hospital. "God is great," he wails, arms raised to the sky. Footage shared by people on the ground in Gaza show rescue workers searching for survivors under buildings destroyed by Israeli bombs. At the hospital, the scenes were chaotic. The Israeli airstrikes were the most intense since the ceasefire took effect. They were also a reminder of the fragility of peace in Gaza.
"We are living in uncertainty, in fear, in terror, every moment of every day."
Ezzedine Shahab is a doctor in Gaza. He sent me voice messages following the attacks.
"Our lives are suspended by political decisions and negotiations that we are not even part of."
Both Israel and Hamas have been accusing each other of violating the ceasefire. Israel points to the recent killing of two of its soldiers, while Hamas says Israel is killing Palestinians in the territory. Michael Koplow is with the Israeli Policy Forum, based in the U.S. He says it seems that the two sides have settled into a new normal.
"Both sides can still claim that they're holding to the ceasefire, but they're going to have these tit-for-tat attacks back and forth."
He doesn't see last night's bombing as marking an end to the truce. He says Hamas doesn't want to be seen as the one breaking the agreement, and on the Israeli side, a new large-scale round of fighting in Gaza would not be popular.
"So I think that the logic for the ceasefire still holds, but it's going to be a while before the two sides actually stop firing at each other completely."
Since the ceasefire began, there have been some improvements on the ground in Gaza. A limited amount of aid has been going in, easing the devastating hunger that people have been experiencing since the summer. But aid groups say that most of the food that has gone in is commercial, meaning that people have to pay for it. And for many, the prices are out of reach. Shayna Lowe is with the Norwegian Refugee Council. She tells me her organization hasn't been able to get any aid through for the past 8 months.
"We continue to try, we continue to apply, but we continue to face rejections from the Israeli authorities, and we are not alone."
The NRC typically focuses on providing shelter to displaced families.
"Blankets, bedding kits, sealing off kits, essential aid that will help protect Palestinians from exposure during the winter."
She says these supplies are much needed on the ground, given the level of destruction. Lowe says the Israeli authorities have rejected most of the applications from aid organizations, saying they are not authorized to deliver support in Gaza.
"These are humanitarian NGOs. Most of them, if not all, have valid registrations, and yet we are still being blocked from bringing in essential life-saving aid to Gaza."
The Israeli agency responsible for aid delivery into Gaza didn't respond to my questions by airtime. But in a statement last week, it said that hundreds of trucks carrying food, tents, and medicine enter Gaza every day. Today, President Trump supported Israel's strikes in Gaza. He said Israel should hit back when its soldiers are killed. At the same time, he added that nothing is going to jeopardize the ceasefire. For the World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
More reporting on the fighting in Gaza, plus the regional and global repercussions of the war, is on our website. We are at theworld.org.
The border between Lithuania and Belarus will stay closed for a month. That decision made today by the Lithuanian government. It is the latest move in an ongoing story of large balloons floating over from Belarus and causing repeated disruptions at the airport in Vilnius, Lithuania's capital. Lithuanian officials see the balloon disruption as a deliberate act by Belarus. The situation is people there caught up in massive travel headaches. We'll have more on this news for you tomorrow on The World.
The Netherlands is a leader on drug policies that focus on harm reduction. How it works and why some in the U.S. resist the Dutch approach. That is just ahead. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. There's a saying in recovery circles, you can't get over drug addiction if you're dead. That's the idea behind harm reduction, keeping people alive first and foremost so they have a chance at treatment when they're ready. While it has gotten some traction in the U.S., harm reduction still faces a lot of opposition in some parts of the country, in the South, for example. Drew Hawkins of the Gulf States Newsroom traveled to a place that embraced harm reduction decades ago. He went to the Netherlands and brought back this report.
Just prepare your shots.
Haas Cornielsen is guiding his staff at Mainline, a harm reduction organization in the Netherlands with a punk rock vibe. They're going through a safe injection training. The former high school physics teacher is showing them how to correctly prepare and inject opioids like heroin and fentanyl.
Who sees great ways of harm reduction in driving a car?
The goal isn't to promote drug use. It's to reduce the harm of using drugs. The Netherlands averages around 300 overdose deaths a year. At the height of the country's heroin crisis in the 80s, there were hundreds in just Amsterdam alone.
As it is seen so woke, like, oh, we're taking care for the junkies.
Cornielsen says the Dutch don't embrace harm reduction because they're more tolerant or open to people using drugs. It's because it works. For him, it's almost a law of nature.
I'm a physics person, you know, so it's like, do you believe in gravity? It's a hilarious question for that reason. Same goes for harm reduction. It has been proven so many times. So how can you doubt it?
Mainline offers services like syringe exchange and drug checking, all supported by city and national funding. It's a part of a system that's been built over decades.
When you are there, the most thing I think they need is someone to listen to them.
Sultan Baghdadi is an outreach worker with Mainline. We're outside a safe consumption site in Amsterdam. It's a place where people can use drugs under the supervision of medical staff. Inside are a handful of people scattered around tables. Some are smoking crack cocaine, others injecting heroin. Baghdadi hands out brochures about the risk of synthetic opioids like fentanyl, and he sits with people and just talks with them. If they want help or treatment, he can connect them. And that kind of relationship between care, safety, and trust is at the heart of the Dutch approach. And it goes back to that crisis in the 1980s, when the country pivoted to a model that integrates health and law enforcement.
Which one was using drugs? This one?
This one.
So this
openly gebruik.
Dutch police officer Bob Blankenzee flips through his citation booklet during a patrol in Amsterdam's red light district.
Is this like a ticket or like a summons?
No, this is from the government.
Okay.
And this is a restriction for 24 hours of this area. So it's all.
If someone's caught using drugs outside a place like a safe consumption room, it's considered a public nuisance, same as alcohol. Joining us on the patrol is Mo Bakayan, a social worker with the city's health department.
I tell them only what I experienced and how I dealt with it.
Bakayan uses his lived experience as a former addict to connect with people. We stop at safe consumption rooms and shelters. Blankenzee waits outside while Bakayan checks in on people. The red light district is calm and quiet during the day. By night, it's a whole different world. I'm following Blankenzee as the officer patrols the area in plain clothes. His main targets are pickpockets, but we also come across a few people using drugs, like this man smoking crack. Blankenzee gives the man a 24-hour ban from the area. He says he knows in the U.S. he could have arrested him.
And here we try to manage it by light penalties and offer them help. What do you need to get rid of this situation?
When open drug use and people sleeping on the streets was the situation decades ago, this harm reduction approach was pioneered by Dutch activists like Auguste Deloor. He argued that what was needed was a third way.
The first way was police, criminalize the user. The second was the clinics, isolate them from the society.
Deloor says the old ways let people view drug addiction as an individual failure, not a community health issue.
The third way was accept the use of drugs, accept the risks, don't turn away from it, but minimize the risk.
Minimize the risk and keep people from dying. That philosophy also led to national drug checking labs like the one at Trimbos Institute in Utrecht.
So, this is full of drugs.
Researcher Don Vandergaal points to neatly labeled bags, some holding pills, others filled with powders.
It might actually be nitazines, for instance, or fentanyl, but probably it is cocaine.
If a dangerous batch is found, the lab triggers a nationwide red alert on TV, radio, and social media within 24 hours. The Dutch say their system has saved an untold number of lives and helped end their opioid crisis. In the U.S. South, harm reduction faces a lot of resistance. There are no drug checking programs or safe consumption sites, but there are signs of change. Syringe exchange programs are growing, though they're still illegal in places like Alabama and Mississippi. In New Orleans, Caitlin Boyle runs the syringe access program at Crescent Care.
Harm reduction is a deeply politicized thing, but the opioid epidemic isn't.
She says progress is fragile. The program depends on federal funds at risk of being cut under the Trump administration. If they lose that money, Boyle says the impacts would be devastating.
That's the main concern, is like death and losing our people.
The opioid crisis in the U.S. has shown signs of improvement, with overdose deaths finally starting to drop, in part thanks to harm reduction programs in big cities. But there were still more than 80,000 overdose deaths in the U.S. last year. Dutch officials say we could reduce that figure dramatically if we changed our approach to drug use. But in the South and other places, harm reduction still struggles to gain support. For The World, I'm Drew Hawkins, New Orleans.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Morocco has charged more than 2,400 people who were connected to recent protests there. Those charges include armed rebellion and violence against public officials. The demonstrations took Morocco by surprise after a youth-led movement mobilized thousands of people across the country.
A petition in Alberta, Canada, is telling the leader of the province to stop talking about separatism, the CBC reports. Separatists there want a referendum on Alberta's independence, and Premier Danielle Smith supports moves to make it slightly easier to hold that referendum. But a petition delivered yesterday supports Alberta's firm place among Canada's 10 provinces. Organizers of the Forever Canada petition say it shows where Albertans' hearts are on the question.
Getting mowed down on the sidewalk by e-scooters will soon be a thing of the past, in Slovakia at least. Politico Europe reports that the Slovakian parliament passed a 6 km/h speed limit on sidewalks. And that applies to everyone, including pedestrians, which means you have to keep your brisk walk under 3.7 miles per hour. Not super fast. The law goes into effect January 1st.
You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. If you think of a sea monster, what comes to mind? Serpents? Loch Ness? What about the creatures in the deep sea where sunlight doesn't even reach? Are they certified monsters or just creatures we do not yet understand? An exhibit at Harvard University's Museum of Natural History looks at both the real and imagined creatures beneath the sea. It's called Sea Monsters, Wonders of Nature and Imagination, and it is the brainchild of Harvard marine scientist Peter Gerges. We are here at your exhibit on sea monsters, Peter. Mm-hmm. You're a marine scientist. What made you interested in studying things that don't actually exist versus things that do exist in the sea?
I think what really first caught my attention is that I kept meeting people that blurred the lines between the two. For these creatures of the deep, there's a lot of assumptions that are made. So it just sort of occurred to me that there's a story to tell here about how we perceive the creatures that are foreign to us or those with which we're not as familiar.
You have here a display of sea monsters across cultures. And on the map here, it looks like we have sea monsters from all over the world. Is this a pretty universal trend, creating sea monsters in our minds?
Yeah, if you look at this map, you can see many of the monsters in mythologies come from coastal communities or coastal civilizations, but not all of them. And in some cases, the same sea monster has moved across cultures and morphed.
Can you tell me about a few of these sea monsters we're seeing that tell us something about the cultures from which they came?
Sure. In Japan, there's a story about the Omibozu, who are drowned Buddhist monks that have hollow eyes and come up to the surface and try to sink ships. So all of these stories have a backstory that tells us a bit about the cultural identity of the people and the ideas that they hold dear and the ideas that they fear.
So tell me, for example, what the Kraken in Norway tells you about that culture.
I think a lot of times when we see stories of sea monsters among, let's say, maritime nations, it often tells us about, frankly, life at sea, which is hard, lonely, and it is easy to let your imagination run wild. So in the case of the Kraken, I think it's quite plausible that sailors saw a large squid. They may have even seen one engaged with a sperm whale or something of the sort. And if you're on a ship and you look out and you see these big creatures, you feel very small.
I'd love to go look at the maps you have on display here now that are just full of sea creatures off the coast of various places. And I want to ask you about those.
Sure, let's do it. Okay. I think my favorite map is Islandia, which is a map from 1595. Not only does it show many fantastical sea creatures, but it shows them in proximity to the landmass, right, which is in northern Europe here. So if you look at all these creatures, some of them look like they're a half horse, half fish. If you look right below that one, you see one that almost looks like a half pig, half fish. And if you keep looking, you'll even see some that look like they're half bird, half fish. And one of the interesting things about this map is it reflects this idea that for every land animal, there's an equivalent sea animal. I mean, take a look at how pig-like this one's is. It's at the very bottom of the map, and you can see it's got a pig snout, but it also has blowholes.
So you would think that maybe they saw blowholes from whales and imagined what was happening under the surface.
Exactly. On some of these other maps, it seems that sea monsters were drawn on fishing grounds that belonged to the patron who commissioned the map.
Oh, so it was like a stay clear of this area, it's dangerous, but really it was a, I want to be able to catch the fish in this area.
Exactly.
I'm thinking of the old maps on land that say Darby dragons, right, in a specific area. And that, I assume, means this is a dangerous place, don't go here. Right. Do any of these sea monsters indicate, you know, maybe there's dangerous currents here or some other reason that you should not try to take a ship in this location?
Absolutely. If you look at some of these maps that depict, say, Scandinavia, you'll see a number of sea creatures around the waters between Iceland and Scandinavia and in the North Atlantic. And this shouldn't be a surprise to us. Those waters can be challenging in winter. So sea monsters can be used as a warning. But I want to emphasize that most of these maps didn't go to sea. Nobody walked around with a folded map that you see here. So the maps were often commissioned by wealthy patrons who wanted to tell a story, right? And so the story is what really excites me, because sometimes the story is stay away from what I own, like a fishing ground, or the story might be heads up, these are some dangerous waters. Oh, and by the way, my great sailors have been there. Or the story is more philosophical.
We're looking at maps that date back to, you know, 1500s and maybe longer. I'm wondering, now that we do know a bit more about the deep sea, are we still creating modern sea monsters in our minds?
When I read news articles about discoveries in the deep sea, I find that in many times the journalists or writers aren't creating monsters in this same sense, but they are endowing these creatures with a degree of mystery and sometimes monstrosity that's exaggerated.
And do you think that happens more with deep sea creatures versus any other creature that might be unfamiliar to us?
Oh, I think so, because the deep sea creatures are so different looking. Take squid. Squid freak a lot of people out, right? Look at all the arms, for crying out loud. Like, what chance could you possibly have in an arm wrestling match or anything of the sort? So they're, it's unsettling. I think that's a theme. The creatures of the deep are often so different in appearance and form than we are, and that what we're used to, that they're unsettling.
You mentioned the anglerfish as something that was kind of popularly made into a monster,
right,
when it is not. I think you have a photo of that over on this wall. Maybe we could go look at it and you could tell me more about that.
I would be happy to, but not only do we have a photo, we have an anglerfish.
Oh.
Let's go for a walk.
It's so tiny.
Right?
It's what, an inch and a half long?
I mean, if you're lucky, right? It is really small. Her little antenna is a lure, and it ends in a little glowy thing, this bioluminescent organ, right?
I think that's what people know about anglerfish.
Exactly.
And from movies and things like that, yeah.
That's right, and we think she uses it to lure prey. She's also an ambush predator, and what that means is she just sits and waits until food comes along and then eats what she can. Otherwise, she's expending energy she doesn't have to burn. Like, she doesn't get that much food. So she doesn't swim around hunting things the way anglerfish are portrayed in kids' cartoons. In one particular kids' cartoon, anglerfish were shown, you know, chasing the heroes of the movie and snapping at them. And I'm watching this, and I'm like, well, this is fun, but it's totally wrong. And that's okay. I'm not going to ruin it for my kids. I'm not going to be that dad that's like, well, actually, children. But it is cool to think that this anglerfish bears no resemblance to the one in that movie.
And why do you think it's important not to demonize things in the deep sea or think they're very dangerous?
When our understanding of an organism or an ecosystem or anything really is based on inaccurate information, it means that our actions are equally misplaced. So a lot of times people have this sense that, for example, for the last 150 years, people still think, oh, there's nothing alive at the very bottom of the ocean. That is factually inaccurate. The deep sea is 80% of our planet's living space. 80%. So if you think about everywhere on Earth where organisms can live, from the Serengeti to the deserts to the Arctic, 80% of it is deep, dark, cold seawater below the reach of sunlight, deeper than 1,000 meters. The animals and microbes, and especially the microbes that live there, shape the health of our entire ocean system, period. And so if we proceed with a wrong set of assumptions about the deep sea, and we're like, oh, well, you know, these animals are weird and creepy, there's not that many of them, we can, whatever, they don't matter, then our ability to take care of the ocean is diminished. And you don't have to be a nature lover to want to take care of the ocean. You don't have to love the anglerfish. But I think we have to recognize that our well-being is tied to their well-being.
A good takeaway from this exhibit. Thank you so much, Peter.
You are very welcome.
Peter Gerges is a marine scientist and the creator of an exhibition at the Harvard Museum of Natural History, Sea Monsters, Wonders of Nature and Imagination. Head to theworld.org for images of those maps we looked at and specimens in the exhibit. That's at theworld.org.
Little Syria was the name of a neighborhood in 1920s Manhattan that was a cultural hub for Syrians in New York City. It's also the title of a hip-hop musical in which poet and rapper Omar Offendom brings the neighborhood of Little Syria back to life. He explained it to Meclita Darrow for the series Movement.
On stage, I'm talking about it from the frame of reference of this like imaginative 1920s Syrian New York neighborhood, but it's infused with elements of today and I think what hits the hardest is just like, for example, in a song like Not Quite White, where you hear headlines from newspapers from back then that sound like they were written today. You know, Arabs not wanted, Syrians must go back, Syrians must be deported.
The frontier of your whiteness, my North African blackness, the West Asian persuasion, don't make sense on an atlas. I was your road to Damascus, gave you the keys and the access, all you needed was some time.
Omar first began working on the Little Syria show in 2018 during a year-long residency at the University Musical Society in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The idea was to develop a theatrical live music performance that could help Arab Americans better grapple with and understand their identity in the U.S. By the time Omar landed the residency, he'd spent over a decade sharing his own experience as a Syrian American through music and performance. Growing up in Northern Virginia, one way Omar learned about Damascus was through stories. At home, his mother kept a bookcase full of Arabic poetry.
So I remember seeing a lot of these covers, a lot of these titles. I remember her reading from them occasionally, and then reading to me occasionally, and seeing lines in them. And when I had my residency in Ann Arbor, I brought one of those books out.
That book was a collection of poetry, one that was well loved by his mother. It's called Diwan by Elia Abu Mahdi, one of the most prominent poets to come out of New York City's Little Syria.
I remember just like plopping myself on the couch in this Airbnb and just opening up this book. And it was one of the very first things I read. And it was almost like screaming out, this is the foundation of your journey. And basically the lines were, هَجَعَ النَّاسُ كُلَّهُمْ فِي الْمَدِينَةِ وَتَوَلَّتْ عَلَى نُو يُورْكِ السَّكِينَةِ وَجُفُونِي بِغَمْضِهَا مُسْتَهِينَةِ لا ترى غير طيفي تلك الحزينة لست أعني بها سوى سوريا. And so he said, fast asleep are all the people in this beautiful city, falling upon New York, a feeling of tranquility. Yet my eyelids in their closing still deceive me as they see nothing but that enduring sadness that bereaves me, to which, of course, I could only mean one thing, Syria.
In the 1880s through the 1940s, Washington Street to Rector Street in Lower Manhattan was home to Little Syria. It was the landing place for thousands of immigrants from Greater Syria and became the cultural and intellectual hub for New York's earliest Middle Eastern community. The first Arab language newspaper in the U.S. was printed in the neighborhood, and it's the birthplace of the Pen League, a collective of writers like Khalil Gibran, who helped revitalize Arab literature.
The idea that this neighborhood existed, that these writers wrote while they were here, that they were influential, almost was planted in me from my mother, from her friends. But it was interesting that nobody really commemorated it, you know? Physically, the way that you would like Little Italy or Chinatown, you know what I mean? Like, it's pretty much gone.
By the 1940s, the once bustling Little Syria neighborhood had dispersed. Many residents were evicted for the construction of the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel in 1950 and settled elsewhere in the city. Today, besides a few lingering buildings like St. George's Syrian Catholic Church and a tenement on Washington Street, Little Syria is physically unrecognizable.
Had they not taken the time to create this art, to publish these newspapers, we wouldn't know nearly as much about the neighborhood as we do now. So
that's right.
In a way, working on this project in the process of it was healing and helped give me the motivation to want to keep doing it.
One of the most powerful ways these stories came through in the Little Syria show is in its music. The show's sound began taking shape during that same residency with help from Omar's friends and collaborators. Thanks, Joey, a Syrian-American producer and beatmaker, and Ronnie Miley, a Palestinian-American ethnomusicologist and oud virtuoso. As long as I am able to put rice and lamb shanks on the table, give thanks, putting cousins on the payroll till banks know my name, Omar.
Speaking into existence while my ancestors dreamed a glimpse in near extinction. So Rani, with his oud and his various hand drums and percussive instruments and his little MIDI keyboard, Joey with his drum machine and a bunch of records that he'd picked up over the years that he thought could work for this album, namely some from his grandfather, and sort of piecing that all together slowly, and everything just felt so natural.
Omar has since developed what he started with Joey and Rani into an 85-minute production of The Little Syria Show. It officially premiered in 2022 to a sold-out crowd at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Over the years, they've taken Little Syria on the road to Chicago, Los Angeles, and most recently back to New York. Why is it important for you to tell this story now?
You know, when Little Syria was a thing, people referred to themselves as Syrians, whether they were Lebanese or Palestinian, what have you. This was Greater Syria. At the time, Khalil Gibran had dreamed of a free Syria, one that was free from Ottoman colonial sort of chains, so to speak, and also free of foreign meddling as well. So actual free Syria. And I've seen more conversation around, at least even just in our speech, restoring some of those previous ways of identifying ourselves, like knowing that while, of course, we're proud of our Palestinian and Jordanian and Lebanese and Syrian roots, we also understand there, you know, these like nationalistic borders are drawn by the French and the British weren't drawn by us, and that we are cohesively people of Bilad al-Sham, the Shami people, and no amount of checkpoints and walls can change that.
Omar Effendim spoke with Makhlit Hedero for Movement. For more stories on music and migration, search for Movement wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. One death every minute. That is the human cost of rising temperatures, according to a major new report on climate change and health published today. The data comes from the Lancet Countdown, published annually by scientists who track how climate change is affecting our health outcomes. Maria Wallewender works on the Lancet Countdown. She's a research fellow who joined us today from London.
Globally, we know that in the last few years, the average person saw about 19 heat wave days. And we know that 16 of those would not have happened without climate change. And it's through being able to quantify that, that we can start putting numbers against the exposures that people are having to dangerous heat.
And are the deaths that are happening due to heat because of climate change all happening during these acute heat waves? Or is there also an impact from just steadily higher temperatures all the time?
It's really a both and. So incredibly hot heat wave days can be quite dangerous for people, but we're also starting to learn more about the dangers of prolonged exposure to heat, particularly in places that aren't used to it. So when those folks are now exposed to dangerous heat wave days or just prolonged periods of extended heat, it's quite taxing on their systems, and they often don't have the types of measures in place to keep themselves safe.
So are these heat-related deaths concentrated in particular parts of the world?
As with many things related to climate change, the impacts are not evenly spread throughout the world. So we see higher rates of heat-related mortality in Africa, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, which is a historically low emitter when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. And while we do see heat-related deaths in most corners of the globe now, they are higher in places that have traditionally had very low emissions.
a lot of the health impacts we've touched on so far are rather acute. I'm wondering if you or others in this field have a good way of studying the long-term health impacts of catastrophic natural disasters that are made worse by climate change. I'm thinking specifically of, for example, the flooding in Pakistan a few years ago that wiped out a lot of crops and livestock and then led to malnutrition. Mm-hmm. Is there a good sense of what that means for, you know, the kids who were young during that time or babies born during that time?
Yeah, so we are increasingly tracking not just acute, but also long-term effects of a variety of climate impacts. On heat specifically, we know that extreme heat exposure is quite dangerous during pregnancy and in early age. And so that can have impacts on preterm delivery or an increased risk of stillbirth. But we also, kind of taking a somewhat more systems view, we know that in 2024 alone, record-breaking heat led to the loss of about 650 billion potential work hours, and that most heavily impacted the agricultural sector. And when we couple this with the record-breaking amount of land that was experiencing drought in 2024, we've already been able to see that an additional 125 million people are reporting that they're experiencing moderate or severe food insecurity specifically related to those heat wave days and drought months.
So your study calls for an end to continued investment in fossil fuels and reduction in burning of fossil fuels, because that is the primary driver of our warming climate. But are there other calls to action when it comes to, you know, addressing specifically the health impacts of climate change that you think we should be seeing or we already are seeing?
Despite the fact that climate change is an incredibly large, pervasive, and complex issue, when we implement the types of solutions that we know work, we see the impact both immediately and in the long term. So a good example of this is when we do transition away from dirty fossil fuels like coal, the air that we breathe is cleaner. So we have reduced our coal usage in certain parts of the world. And in doing so, we've prevented about 160,000 deaths per year just due to the cleaner air that folks are breathing.
But there's still, what, 2.5 million people who die each year because of air quality impacted by coal use? Is that right?
Yeah, there's about 2.5 million deaths per year from the burning of fossil fuels. So that includes both coal and liquid and gas forms of fossil fuels. And there's another few million deaths from burning things like biomass and other sources of particulate matter from human activity.
So combined, do more people die because of burning fossil fuels directly than because of the impacts, the climate impacts of burning fossil fuels?
It's a good question. It's a bit hard to quantify a specific number of here are exactly how many people died due to climate change because it is so pervasive and hard to attribute specifically back for some of the more indirect effects. But what we do know is there's 500,000 deaths per year just from heat. We're seeing hundreds of thousands of deaths from exposure to wildfire smoke. We're seeing the millions of deaths from the direct burning of fossil fuels and the dirty air that creates. So climate change is leading to millions of deaths per year, both directly and indirectly through its impact on a variety of systems and a variety of social determinants of our health.
I'm curious, has your work taken you into the field to see these kinds of weather events and experience what people are experiencing on the ground?
Yeah, so I think what's really true about climate change is it's impacting every corner of the world. So you don't have to travel too far to experience it firsthand. I work really closely with incredible collaborators of the Landsat Countdown who are based all around the world, including in Jamaica, who they do work specifically focused on the hazards and the vulnerabilities of small island developing states. And just over the last few days, they've also been on the receiving end of an incredibly dangerous hurricane that is likely, at least in part, a result of the climate change that they're studying.
Maria Wallewender joined us from the Landsat Countdown, a global annual look at how climate change is affecting human health. The new report shows that on average, one person dies every minute due to rising temperatures caused by climate change.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out our original reporting on YouTube. That's also where you can subscribe to our channel. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.